So today we're entering the 23rd chapter of this book, and the story that God is teaching here through Ezekiel is called the parable of the two harlots or the two prostitutes. And as we've seen, God uses parables, he uses images, he uses stories. He's had Ezekiel shave part of his head. He's had him build ramparts and show what, in model form, what the Babylonians were going to do. And he had him go through all kinds of gyrations. In a few weeks, we're going to go over a new section where he takes Ezekiel's wife's life, and she dies, and he's still a relatively young man, and his grief is causing him to bring the grief of God through these scriptures. So God uses all kinds of devices to get to the world with his message of people need to come to God because God loves us, God wants a relationship with us, and he wants to bless us, but not if we're apart from him and we want sin more than we want him. So we're going to look at the first 10 verses, and we're going to set the stage for the rest of this parable that we'll see over the next few weeks, because this is a rather lengthy chapter, just like number 16 was with the parable of that whole nation, Israel's past, present, and future, as God laid it out. Oh, here's Ezekiel 23, verses 1 to 10, and I'm reading again in the American Standard Version of 1901. The word of Jehovah came again unto me, saying, Son of man, there were two women, the daughters of one mother, and they played the harlot in Egypt. They played the harlot in their youth. There were their breasts pressed, and there was handled the bosom of their virginity. And the names of them were Oholah, the elder, and Oholibah, her sister. And they became mine. And they bare sons and daughters. And as for their names, Samaria is Oholah, and Jerusalem is Oholibah. And Oholah played the harlot when she was mine, and she doted on her lovers, on the Assyrians, her neighbors, who were clothed in blue, governors and rulers, all of them desirable young men, horsemen riding upon horses. And she bestowed her whoredoms upon them, the choicest men of Assyria, all of them, and on whomsoever she doted, with all their idols, she defiled herself. Neither has she left her whoredoms since the days of Egypt. For in her youth they lay with her, and they handled the bosom of her virginity, and they poured out their whoredom upon her. Wherefore I delivered her into the hand of her lovers, into the hand of the Assyrians, upon whom she doted. These uncovered her nakedness. They took her sons and her daughters, and her they slew with the sword. And she became a byword among women, for they executed judgments upon her. Now, this is a powerful introductory to this long parable that we'll look at over several sessions. It starts with the first two verses discussing this mother, this one mother. The word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Son of man, there were two women, the daughters of one mother. This parable is going to discuss what the Lord calls spiritual harlotry. Just like chapter 16, except chapter 16 focused on breaking the marriage vows. And this one is going to talk about Israel's worldliness, how worldly they were. They made treaties and alliances with other nations, and they looked at these treaties as being more dear to them, stronger, if you will, for protecting them, giving them safety and comfort, than what God wanted to give them. They moved away from the protection God guaranteed, and they went after, as this text is going to say, a whoring after the world. A whoring after the world. They should have had total dependency on God, and he would have managed the nations around them. But they didn't. They didn't. What they represent here that we can see in today is a desire to free our souls away from the constraints of God when it's exactly the opposite. These constraints that people view as being God's laws are here for a reason to protect us. They're here to guide our path through our time on this world, to give us the best possible life. But people want to throw this off as it's a difficult yoke and just say, I don't want to do that. I don't want that restraint. People want to satisfy themselves apart from the commandments of God. It never works out. There may be some temporary pleasure that you think you're getting away with, as with the Jews here, but it never lasts. So God faults them most for the spiritual sins that they engaged in. The references here are going to be to sexual immorality, and God aligns sexual immorality with idolatry and sinful practices. So it's actually imagery or a metaphorical comparison, if you will, between spiritual departure from God and corruptness with departure from a sound, sexually secure relationship in a marriage to be promiscuous, go outside of that comfort. So this spiritual fornication here is people going after these occultic non-gods. We see the same thing in the 16th chapter of Ezekiel. So this imagery here is a illustration, if you will, that through prostitution, Israel departed from normal sexual intercourse inside the confines of a secure marriage that God gave us, to leave that and go out and commit fornication, subject yourself to disease, difficult circumstances, pain, harm. It's been said that a prostitute has the coldest heart of all women. And they wanted that cold relationship with these other countries and these other gods that are non-gods more than they wanted a warm, secure, loving relationship with God. God called them out of all the people groups in the world to bless them. And there are many illustrations that we have seen so far in the first 22 chapters of this book describing Israel's sins in a variety of ways, variety of illustrations, variety of models and whatnot that God is working through Ezekiel with. But I can tell you, all of this is just a small reflection of how painful they have been to God. The God of the universe suffers at the sins of his children. And in what we have in the Old Testament is the calling of a particular nation, the nation Israel. God blessed them beyond all nations of the earth in a variety of ways, and they departed from him. So this is going to show us this small amount of displeasure that he has. God starts this chapter by talking about a parent-child or parent-children relationship that existed in Israel. Mother is cited as being a parent that had two daughters. The mother is illustrating the fact that the nation was a single unit. We see it starting with a family, The family gets to be about 70 people. During that time, they start looking at themselves as a nation. Now, we can go back farther. We can see that the nation was in the loins of Abraham, but they hadn't become a realized nation until Jacob, his name was changed to Israel. They migrate down to Egypt, and down in Egypt, they grow into an enormous nation. Probably a couple million people. It's way over 600,000 men alone, over 20. You start doubling that with the women and the children, they're up around 2 million people that came out in the Exodus. They continued unified, if you will, wandering for 40 years and then going in under General Joshua into the Promised Land. They were still unified under the judges. And then Samuel appoints the first king, Saul. It's a unified monarchy. David succeeds him, a unified monarchy. Solomon succeeds him, a unified monarchy. And then after Solomon, about 931 or so, there was a civil war that split, became two daughters. This is the imagery that we're given here. Two daughters. One goes to the north, and the other goes to the south. Actually, they didn't go anywhere because the nation had been divided up into a series of regions resembling the children, the sons, if you will, of Jacob, the 12 sons whose name had been changed to Israel. Jacob's second youngest child is Joseph. Joseph has two children, Ephraim and Manasseh. And at the time, the nations or the sons were blessed by Jacob just before his death. We see this in the 49th chapter of Genesis. Jacob blesses these two children that are not his sons. Everybody's looking at this. What's going on? They became equal with the other sons. And throughout the Bible, every time those 12 sons are mentioned, one of them is left out to accommodate those two, because there's always 12, always 12. So there became 12 regions, 12 regions. Now, Simeon, one of the sons, he didn't have his own region. He was in Judah, but he didn't have his own property, and the Levites didn't have their own property either. Now, it's interesting to see that, but what we need to be able to realize here, one nation with 10 of these sons, geography went to the north, two stayed in the south, essentially Judah and Benjamin. Now, the south was called Judah, but it reflected the whole region with Benjamin and Simeon living there too. And the north was primarily referred to as Ephraim, even though that was only one of the regions, also called Israel. So we see these different terminologies in the Old Testament. Ephraim was the name that we're going to see this referred to in this passage. So the text moves on, and they played the harlot in Egypt. They played the harlot in their youth. There were their breasts pressed, and there was handled the bosom of their virginity. And the names of them were Oholah, the elder, and Oholibah, her sister. And they became mine, and they bare sons and daughters. As for their names, Samaria is Oholah, and Jerusalem is Oholibah. So here's the text moving on to describe these two regions after the Civil War, which caused the 10 tribes to go to the north, led by a guy named Jeroboam, and the southern two tribes split. That was under Rehoboam. That was Solomon's son. We got a civil war. This, everything breaks apart. Two harlots now, two harlots. And while they were in Egypt, meaning back under the one mother before the two, they played the harlot in their youth. Israel had loose morals while they were in Egypt for that 400 years. We see that in the 20th chapter, 2 verses 7 to 8, where that was discussed. Now, God describes in sexual terms the level of their harlotry while they were in Egypt. He says they're having their breasts pressed, and there was handling of the bosom of their virginity. So this is a description, if you will, or an illustration of the level of their sexual immorality, their spiritual licentiousness, because he's comparing, again, sexual activity and immorality with their spiritual immorality. And it's showing that the sexual construct here is only advancing to the stage of what in common terms would be foreplay. Didn't go beyond that. That's all you did there. It's bad enough. It's bad enough what you did, but you were just teasing and you were tempting. You hadn't gone to full intercourse compared to what was going to happen later during the time just before the last Babylonian captivity. That's what is going to happen just before 586 BC. He's going to describe them later in this chapter as being fully sexually immoral. And this metaphor of squeezing the breast is just referring to it hasn't been complete intercourse yet. God ties sexual immorality throughout the Old Testament to spiritual immorality, and he calls it spiritual fornication. Spiritual fornication. It's just a blatant departure from God's laws, or you just don't care. The names here are so important to understand. Ohel is the Hebrew name for a tent. And at that time, the Israelites lived in tents. So they lived in tents. Oholah, the elder, it's in Hebrew, it means her tent. Her tent. Hebrew words morph, change if you will, to determine direction of something, the number of something, and possession of something. So Oholah means her tent. And that represents the northern 10 tribes that had their headquarters in Samaria. The Jews call that Shomron. Shomron. The northern kingdom had been called Shomron for quite a while. At the very beginning, after the split, the civil war, Jeroboam established this place up there, but it wasn't a fully developed city because King Omri, about 50 years later, developed it into a big city, and it got to be the pagan headquarters, if you will, of the northern kingdom. Now, Oholibah, the southern kingdom, means my tent is in her. Oholibah is a morph about hell into much larger text there, but it means with the possessive suffix is my tent is in her. And these are significant names because in Judah, where Jerusalem was, where the temple was where God would appear in the Holy of Holies of the temple. It was his home. My tent is in her. My tent is in her. And God would stay there until just before 586 BC, the cherubim would lift him up. And we've seen this in several places in the earlier chapters of Ezekiel. God never lived in Samaria. We can just see that by the meaning of these Hebrew words. Her tent and my tent is in her. He never lived in Samaria. As a matter of fact, Jeroboam, the first guy who was a king up there, immediately started pagan worship. And they started worshiping this golden calf right away. Well, a lot of the genuine believers at that time left and went down to Jerusalem. We see that in 2 Chronicles 11:16. They weren't going to stay there. So it became completely paganized. And every king after that was a pagan. They could care less about God. There was no good kings in the north, not one. And this is reflected here. And you see this. There's no good kings, no good prophets. There's nothing up there. Nothing up there. They didn't even pretend to go after God. They were just raw pagans and could care less. They wanted nothing to do with this. The two sisters were married to one man, which is God, but Oholah chose to live in a separate tent away from him. And almost immediately, she's engaging in fornication, also known as spiritual idolatry, with men from other countries in her tent, away from the protection of her husband. Now, the other sister initially focused on her husband's tent because he thought of her as my tent is with her. But anyway, before too long, she succumbs to the same pressures of worldly desires, and she's going after other countries, making alliances, wanting to be like the pagans around there. So there were a total of 20 kings in the southern kingdom, and only 8 of them were good. That's not a good percentage. There were 8 good kings, though. There were 8. So the text moves on here where Oholah, up in the north, courts the Assyrians. And this is interesting to see what happens. And Oholah played the harlot when she was mine, and she doted on her lovers, on the Assyrians, her neighbors, who were clothed with blue, governors and rulers, all of them desirable young men, horsemen riding upon horses. And she bestowed her whoredoms upon them, the choicest men of Assyria, all of them, and on whomsoever she doted, with all their idols, she defiled herself. Excuse me. She had a dependent relationship with the Assyrians. And this is well documented, even in secular history. It was a relationship that God said sealed their doom because he ended up causing the Assyrians, whom they were whoring after, to destroy them and carry them off to Assyria as slaves, 722 B.C. So Israel's relationship with Assyria is well documented. I've got a couple of pictures in your notes there, one of which shows a black obelisk, which is a stone, a pyramidal-shaped stone about 5 feet tall, that the Assyrians used to carve the messages of their conquest, their significant conquests on. And on one section of that, I've highlighted that one section where somewhere around 856 to 824 BC, Jehu, the son of Omri, one of the northern kings, is pictured as bowing down to the Assyrian monarch. They went to the Assyrians and bowed down and kissed their feet and said, protect us. We need you. They left God, and there's no better protection. There's no better comfort. There's no better security. But they didn't trust God because they'd thrown him out so long ago. So Syria also, now not Assyria, but Syria was coming into Israel's land in the Transjordan, which is what we would call Jordan today, and during Jehu's reign. But instead of relying on God, trusting God, Jehu, he's allied with Israel and with Assyria. Or he allied Israel with Assyria, and he submits himself as a vassal. And we see the picture there in that stone. He becomes a servant to the Assyrian king, And the net result of this is disaster, because the Assyrians come a while later and cart them away. Now, there were the Assyrians were extremely wealthy, and as the text said, there was young men all dressed in blue and so on with horses. Menahem and Hoshea were two other kings of the northern tribes, and they also paid tribute to Assyria. These folks were not thinking through what the end result would be of doing these things. Instead of God, they allowed the unthinking pursuit of this bodily gratification or this need for security apart from God, and it just led to their defilement. And it happened quickly, too. The prophet Hosea, who lived about 760 to about 720, rebuked Israel for her reliance on Assyria for her security and safety instead of God. Lust will blind us. Apart from God, our lustful desires will blind us to the truth of God and cause us to get in all kinds of havoc. This is what they did. Lust overtook the Jews' clear thoughts and the truth of God's laws, and it dragged them down into perdition. So the text moves on here. They even go to Egypt for help. They even go to Egypt instead of going to God. Neither hath she left her whoredoms since the days of Egypt. For in her youth they lay with her, and they handled the bosom of her virginity, and they poured out their whoredom upon her. Wherefore I delivered her into the hand of her lovers, into the hand of the Assyrians upon whom she doted. These uncovered her nakedness. They took her sons and daughters, and they slew with the sword. And she became a byword among women, for they executed judgments upon her. Once Israel had found herself as a vassal to Assyria, and how bad they were, they wanted to extricate themselves. They wanted to pull out, and they couldn't do it. The Assyrians would no longer let them do it. So it's sort of like a drug addict, you know. They think they're having fun in the beginning, and then they're hooked. And they go, oh, man, I didn't want this. Shouldn't have done it in the first place. And that's where they had gotten themselves. So her love affair turns sour with Assyria, and Assyria becomes her mortal enemy. King Hoshea ben Elah of the northern 10 tribes, and again, which is known as Ephraim, because we're going to see this passage in Hosea calling Ephraim, or represented the northern 10 tribes as Ephraim, he goes to Egypt for help, and he tells the people what his thoughts are. God is doing this. God is now telling his thoughts about this event through the prophet Hosea regarding these people in the north. They're leaving the security of me, and they're trusting in Egypt instead of him. There's an interesting study in the Bible of coming out of Egypt. And we see part of that study here in this chapter. Look what God says about this particular time. And he says this through Hosea. And Ephraim is like a silly dove without understanding. They call unto Egypt. They go to Assyria. When they shall go, I will spread my net upon them. I will bring them down as the birds of heaven. I will chastise them as their congregation hath heard. Woe unto them, for they have wandered from me. Destruction unto them, for they have trespassed against me. Though I would redeem them, yet they have spoken lies against me, and they have not cried unto me with their heart, but they howl upon their beds. They assemble themselves for grain and new wine, and they rebel against me. Though I have taught and strengthened their arms, Yet do they devise mischief against me. They return, but not to him that is on high. They are like a deceitful bow. Their princes shall fall by the sword for the rage of their tongues. This shall be their derision in the land of Egypt. God doesn't hold back. He's saying, you're trusting in Assyria. You're trusting in Egypt. You got it all wrong. You got your focus in the wrong spot. It's like trying to fish in a pond that doesn't have any fish. You know, it's just not going to work. They're in the wrong spot. Whoredoms, or promiscuity, which is what he's really saying here, it just symbolizes the misguided thoughts and their politically motivated actions that symbolize these alliances instead of the true benefactor, God, the creator of the universe, that chose them to bring his laws to them, to teach them how to live, to give them practices to elevate them above all the nations of the earth, and he would bring his Messiah. In terms of Egypt, it seems like they've never really lost their attraction for the time they sojourn in Egypt. Or 400 years. The Old Testament has many references to them wanting to go back to Egypt. And I can tell you the first one was during the Exodus. They're complaining, they're murmuring to Moses, to God. Why do we have to do this? Isaiah, during the time of Sennacherib of Assyria, God says through Isaiah in Isaiah 31, verses 1 to 3, woe to them that go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses and trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong. But they look not to the Holy One of Israel, neither seek Jehovah. Yet he also is wise and will bring evil and will not call back his words, but will arise against the house of the evildoers and against them, against the help of them that work iniquity. Now the Egyptians are men and not God, and their horses flesh and not spirit. And when Jehovah shall stretch out his hand, both he that helpeth shall stumble and he that is helped shall fall. And they shall all be consumed together. You know, God makes this clear over and over and over again that our relationship and our help is with him, not with pagan alliances with other countries, not trying to go back to some previous time when we were sinful and experienced pleasure in this lust. The first time that this happened, that they wanted to go back to Egypt, was, as I mentioned, in the Exodus. In the Exodus. And since then, they've desired this many times. Look what Exodus 16:3 says. This is the first time recorded. Probably they were screaming about it as they were crossing the Red Sea. And the children of Israel said unto them, would that we had died by the hand of Jehovah in the land of Egypt when we sat by the flesh pots, when we did eat bread to the full. For ye have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. They had plenty to eat, but they complained and they murmured and they wanted to go back to Egypt. So, in addition, when she finally attempted to break away from Assyria, she joined forces with Syria and Egypt, and she incurred the anger of the Assyrians. Finally, God says, okay, I'm going to give all of Israel here, including Samaria, over to her lovers, the Assyrians, whom she lusted after, and they killed her. They killed her. In 722 B.C., the northern 10 tribes, headquartered at Samaria, also known as Shomron in Hebrew, fell to Assyria. And they carted them away, and they repopulated the area with a number of different people from other people groups. And what few Jews left there intermarried with them, and the progeny became half-breeds, which were called the Samaritans in Jesus' time. And they were just rejected by the Jews. They rejected them. Jesus didn't reject them, but the Jew, the ruling Jews did. And this thing closes with, you, this whole thing that happened to you is going to become a byword amongst women. In other words, people are going to say, hey, don't do that. You'll be like the Assyrians. You'll be like the Jews that went after the Assyrians. Don't do that. Don't be going down to Egypt now. It became, and we don't see that today, but you know, this is a long time ago, this is 722 B.C., but that was a byword amongst people to correct somebody and say, hey, don't do that because, you know, it's a way of correcting people and saying to them, God wants you to have a relationship with him. And if we had solid relationships with God, these things wouldn't happen. It's been that way since the Garden of Eden. God is long-suffering, and he's still suffering. Someday it's all going to come to an end, and there will be an enormous correction that comes on this earth when God brings his tribulation and then returns at the end of that to set up his kingdom. Let's pray.